Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
Into the early life of Jorge Avila Torres. So Jorge Avila Torres, who prefers to be called George, was born on August 18th in 1988 in Zion, Illinois. His parents had emigrated from Mexico. His father worked in a cardboard factory and his mother was a homemaker, an ama de casa. His attorney later said that he had an abusive childhood, but we have no particulars about that and do not know the veracity of that claim.
Yeah, considering what he did later, it makes sense, but we just don't
know.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. We don't know.
But according to his childhood friend, Alberto Seguera, George did not like being at home. He lived with his parents and older sister, Sarah, who he was close to. The family lived in a two-story house on Gabriel Avenue in Zion, two blocks from Beulah Park.
According to Alberto, as a teenager, George was personable. If awkward in conversation, his only interests appeared to be bikes, girls, and his collection of knives and throwing stars. Childhood friends said George could often be seen riding around his neighborhood on his mountain bike.
Another childhood friend, Sarah Cernock, said, quote, he was kind of an outcast. It was like he was there, but he wasn't there, unquote.
Mm.
Alberto said that George talked about girls, but was inept at talking to them and flirting.
Mm.
None of his friends remembered him having a relationship. Alberto said George seemed jealous of his ability to attract girls, and he would sometimes ask him, how do you do that?
Yeah. Although the girls were not impressed by George, he did impress some adults. He didn't drink or smoke cigarettes, and he stayed out of trouble. Alberto's mom liked George, and George often went to Alberto's house to visit him and his siblings, one of whom was Alberto's younger half-sister, Crystal Tobias. So now let's get into the timeline. Hit it, Beth.
On May 8th, 2005, which was Mother's Day, Crystal Tobias, who was 9 at the time, and her best friend, Laura Hobbs, who was 8, went out to play on their bicycles. School officials described Laura Hobbs as an active reader who enjoyed acting out stories with puppets, and Crystal Tobias as artistic, and they both enjoyed playing outside.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Avila Torres, who was 16 at the time, lived in the neighborhood, and as we mentioned, he was acquainted with the girls, since he was friends with Crystal's older half-brother, Alberto.
The girls did not return home that evening, so the family began looking for them and eventually called the police. After a frantic night of searching, at around 6 a.m., Laura's father, Jerry, found the girls' bodies in a remote wooded area of Beulah Park.
So just a quick detail about the girls going out and playing during the day. Apparently, you know, it was Mother's Day, so there was a lot of families and kids out playing at the time. I think the girls were on a single bike, the kind that had the posts.
Oh, okay.
So one was sitting in the chair and the seat and pedaling, and the other one was standing on those posts.
Oh, the pegs.
Yeah, the pegs.
Pegs, yeah.
And you would think it would be a safe place for young kids if there's families and moms and dads around and other kids.
We used to play outside like all day long when I was a kid.
Really? I think that sounds wonderful. I have always just loved sitting inside and watching soap operas.
more than playing outside. I'm sorry. That's my truth. But I love that for you and all children.
I don't think we had a choice. Mom was like, get out.
Oh, no. Oh, my.
Go play.
That was always my worst nightmare. And my parents were like, go outside. No. Like, my programs.
Yeah.
My stories.
We were not watching TV. There wasn't much on when I was a kid anyway.
And I feel so bad for you about that. Oh,
oh no. We had a blast playing outside.
Oh, you did? Oh, it was fun. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Because for me, it was torture. Anyway, so back to the story. Apologies. So the girls were found in a remote wooded area of Beulah Park, and they were found lying on their backs, fully clothed, with multiple stab wounds and bruises, particularly around their necks and faces. Laura had been stabbed 20 times and Crystal had been stabbed 11 times. There was also a significant amount of male DNA found.
Police immediately focused on Jerry Hobbs as a suspect because he had a felony record, which I understand why they initially thought of him as a suspect.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
But they shouldn't have focused only on
tunnel vision.
They had tunnel vision.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure. Mm-hmm. So Jerry Hobbs had moved to Zion in the spring of 2005 after a two-year stint in a Texas prison for chasing a rival for his girlfriend's affections with a chainsaw.
What now?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
That would be terrifying.
Exactly. And are chainsaws gas-powered? So you don't have to be, like, plugged into something.
Some of them are, yeah.
Oh.
Some of them are electric. He probably had a gas-powered one. Because it'd be hard to chase somebody around with a chainsaw that's plugged in.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's why in my head, this would be over as soon as he got far enough away from the socket. but maybe not. So his plan was to reconcile with his girlfriend, who was now living in Zion, and to become reacquainted with his three children. But weeks later, Laura was dead.
Jerry was brought back to the Zion police station by 7:30 that morning. And the questioning began. Investigators thought it was suspicious that an ex-convict who was new to the area discovered the bodies before local residents and the police, and they thought his reaction to finding the bodies was odd, and they felt that his grief seemed insincere.
I hate when people say that that somebody's not grieving in the way that they think is appropriate,
in the right way. Yeah.
Fuck off. But also, okay, maybe it was suspicious that he found the body, but did anybody think this guy's been away for a long time? I mean, he wants to do the right thing. So he wants to find his daughter. He wants.
And he
so
was
motivated.
Searching all night long. So
what?
Yeah.
I mean, I just shame on the police on this one.
Yeah.
Following an interrogation that spanned about 24 hours, Hobbs confessed. He signed a confession stating that when he went to get Laura to come home, the girls resisted. Then Crystal pulled out a small knife and the two girls attacked him.
Hobbs said that he hit them both and eventually got the knife from Crystal and began stabbing her, then stabbed Laura. He was charged with the murders and prosecutors vowed to seek the death penalty.
Side note, did you hear the confession?
I didn't. I don't think I could listen to it.
It was gut-wrenching. It was so brutal to listen to, especially, you know, us knowing that he didn't do it.
And
he's clearly in distress. I mean, severely grieving. And it seemed obvious to me that it was just so painful for him to read the confession that they fed to him. We don't know what happened before the confession tape was turned on.
Right.
And I didn't think he did it just by how he
sounded.
Yeah. So Hobbs later said that he confessed to the crime because he hadn't slept in days and figured that the truth would come out. He said, quote, "I found my daughter. I was already broken. They didn't have to break me," unquote. So they didn't have to do anything to get.
Yeah, he was already broken.
Yeah, exactly. And understandably so.
Mm. Right. So 2 years after his arrest, a private lab hired by his lawyers discovered that sperm had been found on Laura's body, and they tested a sample. The defense lawyers immediately announced that the DNA analysis showed that the DNA did not match Hobbs.
So they let him out of prison, right? No. State prosecutor Mike Mermel didn't care. And that's a thing that prosecutors do sometimes, that are this win at all costs.
Right, which is bullshit.
It is.
It's not a game. You're not playing a game with people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's not win at all costs.
No.
You're trying to get at the truth, asshole.
Right, and do the right thing.
Yeah.
By them sticking to this win at all costs mentality.
This stupid story.
Yeah, it's a miscarriage of justice and they should lose their jobs. Is. I mean, this.
Yeah.
God.
It's terrible.
Mm-hmm. So he suggested that Laura could have got the sperm on her while playing in the woods. What? Where he's, aren't you a learned lawyer with a lot, like
he's
a smart lawyer person?
Yeah.
Anyway, where he said couples went to have sex. Hobbs remained in jail awaiting trial for more than 2 years. In the meantime, the DNA records were put into a nationwide database, and periodically, the state DNA forensic examiner would check for a match.
So I didn't go into the details of how the bodies were found or anything like that.
I know.
You can look it up if you really want to. But
yeah,
one thing that I think is important is that the sperm wasn't found just on her body. Okay. She was raped.
Okay.
So just playing in the woods wouldn't have gotten it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. And it also,
Not
only is it the DA or the prosecutor, it's a miscarriage of justice for the girls because they wasted years not going after somebody. And essentially,
other people in the community and the women who were attacked later and the one woman who
died. And also, I think victimizes unfairly the girls who were sexually assaulted. Like, sort of blaming. It feels victim blaming. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, it does.
I'm just saying.
They were just playing in the woods.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the time Avila Torres was in high school, he had begun getting into trouble.
Mm.
He skipped class routinely. And when he was a senior, he was kicked out of school for marijuana possession.
Mm.
He then went to an alternative school in Waukegan before graduating in 2006. And then he joined the Marines.
After a few months in the Corps, Avila Torres was shipped to Okinawa, Japan for a 2-year hitch. Avila Torres and his friend DeCarlos Jones passed time by playing video games and going to bars near the base.
According to DeCarlos, Torres was fun to be around and, quote, down to earth, unquote. But, DeCarlos said, a Marine base can resemble a high school, and Avila Torres, who was a smaller guy and looked very young, was bullied somewhat by the more popular Marines.
I guess it makes sense, right, that in any small community or like microcosm,
there's going to be, especially the military,
right.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So in April 2009, Avila Torres was assigned to an administrative job in the Washington area and moved into the Keith Hall Barracks at Joint Base Meyer Henderson Hall, a military base located near Arlington, Virginia. And when I said Washington, I meant Washington, D.C., not the state.
Oh,
bitches.
Yeah. The Washington, D.C. area. Yeah. And this, the name of this base, Joint Base Meyer Henderson Hall. So sorry. It's so long. But it is.
Yeah. That is.
And I was very confused because they lived in Keith Hall.
Okay.
And then it's Joint Base Meyer Henderson Hall. So I don't know why, but Keith Hall was the barracks inside the base.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay.
Thank you for clarifying.
You're welcome. So another person who lived in Keith Hall was 20-year-old Navy Petty Officer Amanda Jean Snell. Amanda was from a military family. In high school, she was active in ROTC, and after graduation, she enlisted in the Navy.
She did basic training in Great Lakes, Illinois, then attended the Navy and Marine Corps Intelligence Training Center in Virginia Beach. Ooh, this girl's a star.
Yeah.
In the fall of 2008, Amanda was assigned to the office of the Chief of Naval Operations at the Pentagon. Wow. And moved into Keith Hall Barracks at Joint Base Meyer Henderson Hall.
She made few friends at the barracks, which housed Marines, sailors, and a few Air Force personnel. They all wanted to party hard, and she didn't. Amanda volunteered as a youth minister and worked with autistic children at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church. She just loved children and planned to transition from the military into a job teaching special education.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Amanda was scheduled to work on Monday, July 13th, 2009, but she did not report for duty, and word went out to check her room. The door was unlocked, the bed was made, the room was tidy, but Amanda was found wedged into her wall locker, a pillowcase over her head. She was dead.
So a wall locker is kind of like a metal closet.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And so it's not in the wall. It's like on the wall.
Ah, got you. Like a wardrobe. The Lion, the Witch, and
like
the Wardrobe.
Yes, like a wardrobe. Exactly. Yeah. The Naval Criminal Investigative Service, or NCIS, arrived at 7:45 a.m. and began an investigation. Agents conducted a walkthrough and inventory. They took the temperature of the room and Amanda's body. The medical examiner believed that Amanda had been dead for 24 to 36 hours or maybe more.
Agents took photographs and impressions of shoe prints on the vinyl floor in front of the wall locker. Amanda's laptop was missing, as was her iPod. Oh, remember those?
Yeah.
Agents noticed that the bed was made with only a fitted sheet and a comforter, but the top sheet was missing.
Avila Torres lived down the hall from Amanda. He, like others who lived near her, complied with NCIS's request to complete a personal data sheet in which he indicated that he did not know her and had never been in her room. Mm. He also consented to a search of his room and gave a DNA sample. So they had his DNA.
Yeah. Wow. I don't think I realized that detail until you,
until you said
that.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's better, HELP.com/fruit.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderich.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
So an autopsy showed no bruising on signs of struggle. Tests determined that there was no sexual assault, no rape, no indication of sexual activity. Amanda's family and friends told NCIS investigators that she suffered from migraines and that one way she would ease the pounding was to curl up in a dark place and put a sheet or pillowcase over her head. She also had a slight heart defect.
So, yeah, I suffer from migraines, too, and I do like a dark room,
but
I don't think she would go into her wall locker.
Right.
When you're feeling sick like that, you go to bed.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. This has been Migraine Corner with Beth.
Yeah, you might cover your...
I don't have migraines. I only know what I see in the commercials.
Yeah. Yeah. When I have a migraine, I will sometimes be, or often, will be sick to my stomach as well.
Oh, really?
And so I just, the only thing that makes it go away is sleep.
Really?
At least for me.
Oh.
And so I'll lay in bed and with maybe a pillow over my head, or I have a sleep mask.
Uh-huh.
I'll wear that, but I'm not going to go somewhere else.
Right.
I want to be someplace comfortable.
Now, you wouldn't go, would you go in your closet?
No, I would not go in my closet.
Okay.
So I can't see her doing that.
Okay, got you.
And I don't think that they I'm just guessing. Okay. This is just speculation.
Sure.
I don't think that the family suggested that she did that. I think they just were talking. And it's like, oh. Yeah, sometimes she has migraines. And then the investigators were like, oh, I bet she went in there because she had a migraine. You know, something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
But like I said, I'm just speculating.
That's okay. This is another instance of authorities who should be open to all possibilities. Grab onto one thing, which is the wrong detail, and run with it.
And go with it. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, because there were no witnesses and no evidence of a crime, except for her missing stuff.
Right. Oh, yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Fred. I'm sorry. It's been a long day. You're right. She was. Yes. Yeah. There's that, too.
I just realized that. Yeah.
Oh, man.
But her room did seem undisturbed.
Okay.
And she had a medical history, which might explain why she died. Mm-hmm. NCIS forensic agents thought she could have died of natural causes. And a medical examiner's report ruled the cause of death to be undetermined. But some did suspect foul play, and others suspected suicide.
Interesting. So Avila Torres offered to help the agents with their investigation. That's serial killer behavior.
Yeah.
He volunteered to...
Let me help.
I'm only here to serve. He volunteered to be a quote-unquote inside source for NCIS. Mm-hmm. They accepted and asked Avila Torres to spread a rumor that there was a witness who saw someone entering Amanda's room on the night she died. Surprise, 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 surprise. Nothing came of it. And the case went cold.
Gee, I wonder why.
Seriously. This is... What the fuck?
So on February 5th through the 6th in 2010, a blizzard, which has been commonly referred to as Snowmageddon.
Oh, I remember it.
You remember Snowmageddon?
I remember it. Yeah.
So it hit the northeastern United States and it brought rail and highway travel to a halt and shut down governments and schools. Mm-hmm. Roads were either impassable or nearly empty, and a lot of people were walking to the places that they needed to go.
Yeah, I'll never forget a story of a dad who had to pick up his kid from daycare. The roads were shut down, and he walked like hours to go get his kid.
I guess I would, too.
That's what I would have done, too. But man, oh, man. Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
But during this time, two police officers, T.L. Clifford and Andrew Nuselli, noticed a silver Dodge Durango SUV cruising the streets, sometimes parking and idling. He seemed to be watching people. Clifford made note of the license plate, shout out to Clifford, and the two officers compared notes.
They both felt that this guy, who was a young, clean-cut Latinx male, was up to no good. Officer Clifford called in the plate number, but it came back clean and the officers had nothing to pull him over for. But they did keep an eye out for him, and I think they kept seeing him over... The Snowmageddon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think they only noticed him because there were so few people driving mm-hmm. out on the streets. Mm-hmm. And so if not for Snowmageddon, they may not have noticed him.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Thank you. Oh, gee, I'm true crime. She did it again. So on February 10th, 2010, Katie Mills, that's not her real name, by the way. This woman was a 26-year-old nurse. Was walking to her boyfriend's house in Arlington after a late shift at the hospital. Avila Torres approached her from behind, grabbed her jacket, showed her a gun, and told her to keep quiet and keep walking.
Yeah, so Katie Mills is a name that's used in the media, but it's not her real name. She wants to remain anonymous, so.
All right. Well, let's respect it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Katie told Avila Torres to just take her back, but he kept pushing her towards a Dodge Durango. Then he pulled out a knife, but she still refused to get into the SUV and told him to just take her bag, which she then tossed into a pile of snow, which confused him. And then she bolted towards her boyfriend's house.
Oh, smart. Yeah. She started screaming as she got to his door, and he and his roommates came out when they heard her. The man and the Durango were gone, but they called 911 and Katie helped police create a composite picture of her would-be abductor. However, she thought the Durango had been tan, not silver.
Yeah, so they did not connect it to the silver Durango.
Right.
A little more than 2 weeks later, on February 26, 2010, Avila Torres entertained a friend from Okinawa in his barracks by showing off a new handgun.
Yay!
Yay, guns! The pair ate takeout food before they took Avila Torres's Durango and drove past the White House, then wandered around Washington's Chinatown neighborhood before parting for the evening.
Around 2 a.m. the next morning, February 27th, a woman named Hannah Smith was walking up to her house in Arlington when a man approached her from behind, told her he had a gun, and demanded that she get in his car. The two struggled, and the man used a stun gun. What? But Hannah managed to get away, got inside her house, and called 911.
Yay, Hannah.
So he's tried to, like, attack
he's
two
tried,
people.
Like, all yeah. different, all different ways,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, and it's not working out.
Not working yet.
Yeah.
yeah.
And that's good. That's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
But then bad things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
About an hour and a half later, around 3:30 a.m., two female graduate students, Julie Thomas and Karen Marlotti, which is also not their real names, were walking to Karen's house in Arlington County. They were both 23 years old and had become friends in the fall of 2009.
As they stopped in front of the house, Avila Torres emerged from behind a parked car. He moved a sweatshirt to the side to show the women that he had a gun and demanded their wallets. After the women told him they had no money, he forced them into Karen's house and ordered them to kneel down next to the couch.
He then bound their hands with a vacuum cord. At one point, when Avila Torres left the room, the women were able to loosen their hands. Avila Torres returned to the room with a knife, retied Julie's hands with an iron cord, then ordered the women to go to the bedroom. So he didn't plan this out.
Not at all.
He was just grabbing things from the house
yeah.
to tie them up with.
Yeah. yeah. So when he left the bedroom to search for tape, Karen threw herself against the door and slammed it shut. Yes! The man had patted them down but hadn't found Julie's cell phone. Yeah, right! It sounds like a movie. She was also yeah. able to reach into her pocket and dial 911, and then she dropped the phone into a laundry basket.
But the man barged back in, grabbed the cell phone, and smashed it against the wall. He then took Julie by the arm and led her out of the house and into the street, the iron dangling below her tied hands.
Karen tried to follow to help her friend, but she was still tied to the vacuum. So instead, she screamed and banged the vacuum cleaner around until her roommate woke up, came downstairs, and called 911.
Avila Torres forced Julie into the Durango. After he drove for some time, he stopped, got in the back seat with Julie, and told her he was going to rape her. He put on a condom saying, quote, "I'm not an idiot," unquote, and then raped her. I don't know. I'd have to disagree.
Totally. Yeah. This is not a subjective yeah. matter. This is this is an objective finding. You are a
yes.
dumbass and a terrible person. After he assaulted her, he covered her face with packing tape, then drove to a secluded area and assaulted her again. He then took Julie's scarf and tightened it around her neck until she was unconscious. So now let's get into the investigation and the arrest. What the what, Beth?
So Arlington police went on high alert. They set up a command center and put out an all-points bulletin for an abducted female. Hannah Smith was interviewed. She described her would-be abductor as a short, young guy. Karen Marlotti described her abductor in the same way, saying, quote, "He looked so young. He could have passed for a high schooler," unquote.
That same morning, Thomas and Lynn Love were driving to Potomac Town Center in Woodbridge. They took the scenic route and were enjoying the drive when they noticed something moving in a power line clearing.
Thomas slowed, steered towards the roadside, and stopped. He and his wife Lynn got out for a closer look. They walked towards the clearing, uncertain at first whether they were looking at an animal or a person.
Mm.
But it was a woman, caked with ice and shoeless, crawling towards them.
Mm. Wow. No words.
Yeah.
Blood was coming from her head, and she was shivering and turning blue. Lynn wrapped her in a coat, took her into the truck, and turned on the heat. They called 911. Julie told the Loves that she had been raped and beaten.
When Julie was interviewed by police, she told them that the man had been driving a silver SUV. Officers Clifford and Nucelli remembered the Durango they had noticed cruising aimlessly during Snowmageddon.
Officer Clifford, I love you. Anyway, they were able to match the license plate that they'd run during the time to Avila Torres. Police then showed Katie Mills a photo lineup, and she was able to pick out Avila Torres as her would-be abductor.
Avila Torres was arrested later that day at Joint Base Meyer-Henderson Hall. Police searched his Durango and found Julie's university ID and an earring, packing tape, and a stun gun, as well as a clothes iron, the cord of which was used to bind Julie. In his barracks room, they found a loaded Glock 22 pistol, which he had purchased on February 5th, and multiple rounds of ammunition.
They also seized his laptop and accessories, which contained dozens of sexually explicit videos and images depicting violent rapes and sexual assaults, which were stored between April 2009 and February 2010. And I apologize for giving these details, so fast forward. Many videos were sleeping rape videos, meaning someone is sleeping and is attacked or raped.
Avila Torres's DNA profile was entered into a national database. To the surprise of investigators, it matched the DNA evidence found on Laura Hobbs's body. Jerry Hobbs spent a total of 5 years in jail awaiting trial before prosecutors dropped the murder charges against him and refiled them against Avila Torres.
Finally,
yeah. In August of 2010, Michael Waller, the state's attorney, told reporters he was releasing Hobbs because they could no longer prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is that a euphemism for I fucked up?
I think so, yeah.
So while Avila Torres was awaiting trial for the Arlington crimes, he was held in the Arlington County Detention Facility. Investigators arranged to have a federal inmate act as a confidential informant, and they recorded conversations between the two of them.
Their conversations were recorded for approximately a week in August 2010. During those conversations, Avila Torres confessed to murdering Amanda Snell. He said that he entered Snell's room through her unlocked door, jumped on her as she slept in her bed, bound her wrists with the power cord from her laptop computer, and strangled her with the rest of the cord. Mm.
He then dragged Amanda's body from the bed to her wall locker, in which he hid her body. Then he made the bed and thoroughly cleaned the room, taking the top sheet from her bed, but leaving the fitted sheet.
He also confessed to killing Laura Hobbs and Crystal Tobias and denied feeling any sort of guilt about it. He suggested that he killed the girls because they had witnessed him engaging in some type of drug activity, which is bullshit. Yeah. And he also laughed about the fact that police had charged the wrong man.
Oh, nah, he needs to burn in hell. So yeah. NCIS expedited testing of the fitted sheet from Amanda's room, and technicians discovered a semen stain consistent with Avila Torres' DNA. They also compared his Nike shoes with the footwear impressions found in front of Snell's wall locker. A government latent print examiner later testified that the shoes that made the impressions were consistent in size, design, and wear with Avila Torres' shoes. So now let's get into the trial.
So in 2010, Avila Torres was tried for the crimes against Julie Thomas and Karen Marlotti. He was convicted in Arlington County Circuit Court for abduction with intent to defile, robbery, use of a firearm in a felony, abduction, rape, breaking and entering while armed, and forcible sodomy.
Julie testified in court that she was tormented by flashbacks. Quote, "I can't sleep, and I'm just angry and upset all the time. He's changed the way I live my life," unquote.
On December 10th, 2010, Avila Torres was given 5 life sentences, followed by consecutive sentences totaling 168 years. And on May 26, 2011, Avila Torres was indicted for the murder of Amanda Snell. The indictment alleged aggravating factors supporting a death sentence.
I was going to say.
That was a nice podcast.
That's a nice sentence. That's a nice sentence. So the trial began on March 31st, 2014. The prosecution called more than 30 witnesses over the course of 4 days and introduced hundreds of pages of exhibits. Avila Torres' counsel cross-examined the government's witnesses, but only presented one witness.
On April 8, 2014, the jury returned a guilty verdict. Avila Torres was sentenced to death for the murder of Amanda Snell. Then Avila Torres was extradited from Virginia's Red Onion State Prison to Lake County to face charges in the murders of 8-year-old Laura Hobbs and 9-year-old Crystal Tobias.
In that case, Avila Torres took a plea deal. The judge accepted Avila Torres' guilty plea, calling his crimes, quote, "cruel, cold-blooded, and devoid of mercy," unquote. And he sentenced him to 100 years in prison. Great.
So he's never getting out.
No. Yeah. So now let's get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Avila Torres is currently incarcerated in Virginia. I could not find out where.
Okay. Well, I don't know if anybody listening is interested in contacting him, but that's
don't
fine
care.
By me. in Beulah Park in Zion, where the bodies of Crystal, Tobias, and Laura Hobbs were found, a plaque marks a small tree planted in their memory. That's beautiful.
Yeah. The girls' killing in 2005 and the flawed police investigation that followed focused national attention on the issue of wrongful convictions, and specifically in Lake County, Illinois, where five innocent men were wrongly convicted and DNA evidence that exonerated them was ignored by Michael Waller, the Lake County prosecutor at the time.
I hope he's fired.
Yeah.
County authorities earned a national reputation for imprisoning innocent men. It's not a good look.
Mm-mm.
In ignoring evidence of their own errors. In four of the five cases, prosecutors under former state's attorney Michael Waller continued prosecuting the men after forensic evidence had indicated their innocence. What?
That's awful.
That's not, that's not why you're elected. That's not what you're, that doesn't protect
citizens. That's not what you're supposed to be
citizens.
Doing. No.
Ugh.
No. No. So those five men served a total of 80 years in prison.
Oh my God.
Jerry Hobbs was one of those five. And Hobbs sued after his exoneration and in 2013 received more than $6 million from various law enforcement agencies in Lake County.
I'd say that's great, but it doesn't bring, you know, the girls back.
No, it doesn't bring the girls back. It doesn't bring the time that he, I mean, he lost those 5 years that he was in prison.
Yeah, and didn't get to grieve with his partner or with his surviving kids, right? Like, it's just, it's awful.
Yeah, his kids didn't have him there to lean on, it's awful.
So the money didn't help. But after being released in 2010, Hobbs returned to Wichita Falls, Texas, a small city near the Texas-Oklahoma border. Since then, he's been arrested for drug possession, evading arrest, tampering with evidence, and escaping from jail. But I believe he's a victim of the system.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's why I included these details.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It fucked him up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, let's get into it. Tell us.
Yeah, let's get into
it. We're going to get into our takeaways and what we think made Jorge Avila Torres snap. So what are your thoughts on this, Beth?
So what made him snap? So I don't really know. I mean, he may have had an abusive childhood, but he also, a lot of people noted that he was a small guy. Mm-hmm. He looked young. Mm-hmm. He was awkward with girls. Mm-hmm. He probably felt inadequate.
Yeah.
I think he may have been like an incel.
Yeah. And that can be dangerous if, I mean, an incel is essentially a man who's not good at or incapable of forming outside relationships and as a result is involuntarily celibate.
Right. But it also, it's usually a guy who refuses to believe that it's anything about themselves that it is the problem. The problem is outside of themselves.
It's the world's fault.
It's the world's fault. And specifically women.
Okay. Okay. So, thank you. it's been, I feel like it's been a while since we heard incel like as I haven't heard it much since
in a while.
Yeah, 2016.
So I listened to a podcast about incels and it was how the name started. And it didn't start that way.
It started by a woman.
Yeah. Who was, just talking about not being able to find somebody to date.
Yeah.
And then it turned into this whole incel movement. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are very angry, but they refuse to believe that it's anything to do with them.
Refuse to look inside, do a little.
Inside.
Yeah.
And heal themselves.
Yeah.
Because that's the problem.
Right.
Is
there's
ego. Something wrong.
It's internal.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something wrong. They need some counseling. And, maybe a class on social skills or something would be helpful.
Teaching people who struggle with this how to do it, I think would be, a good solution. But he didn't find it.
He didn't do that. He got angry at women, apparently, killed them.
Yeah.
And I think he targeted Crystal. Well, at the time he was 16, they were little girls, so they were easy targets.
Yeah.
But also Crystal was Alberto's little sister. And I think he was jealous of Alberto and he may have targeted Crystal because he wanted to get back at him or something like that.
Yeah.
It might have been, He may not have even realized that that's what he was doing, but I think there was totally an element of
subconscious. Yeah. And Crystal is the one who was stabbed more times in the eyeballs.
I think that was actually Laura.
Oh, okay.
I think Laura was actually stabbed more, but I'm not 100%.
Okay.
And he was described by the women that he attacked, the ones who got away, as disorganized.
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, evidence of that is like he didn't bring stuff with him. Mm-hmm. He was like doing things on the fly, mm-hmm. looking for tape.
Yeah.
While they were trying to get away.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's like he wanted to do these things, but and like he was stalking these women,
mm-hmm.
but he hadn't really thought through the particulars of how to do it.
Right.
So yeah. I don't think he was the sharpest crayon in the box.
No, doesn't sound like it. It doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. And this is a really sad story.
I think it never ceases
to amaze me how some evil idiot feels like it's okay to kill, even rape and kill children.
Yeah.
Because he feels inadequate.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. And I mean, he was bragging about this when he was in prison to that confidential informant.
Yeah, exactly.
And no shame, no remorse, no nothing. Just
nothing. Yeah.
I can't imagine what would lead a person to that conclusion.
It's disgusting. Yeah. And the police and prosecutors in Lake County during this time can eat a bag of dicks.
That's what I have to say. Also, there's so many bags of dicks that need to be mailed out to Jorge Avila Torres, the biggest piece of basura. Why don't you put some caca in that ship as well? I mean, to do that to, I'll never understand like physically hurting another person, but a child just is
a
wild.
Child.
What the, what
two
in the
children.
World? Yeah. yeah. And, you know, it seemed like he did well in the military.
Yeah,
after
he was doing
after
all right.
he escaped the law and went on the lam and joined the military. But it sounded like he was kind of a high ranking person.
No, I think he was a corporal.
Okay, as I assume corporal was important, like high. I don't know. I don't know anything about rankings. I'm a regular person with no extra letters before my name or after it. So I don't understand any of these military police rankings. It's all gibberish to me. But I heard one podcaster say, actually, she was talking to Mama Margo about this case and said she knew him as Corporal Avila Torres. He went to her house, even held her baby.
Oh, my God.
But it's just like you were saying, he was a monster, the worst kind, hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what's most terrifying about this case is he was a regular looking, unassuming person. With demons, I mean, capital D, about his insecurities.
Yeah.
And took it out on people who were vulnerable or that he thought were vulnerable or less deserving of life than him. I don't know exactly what it was, but I know he wasn't.
Yeah, just like you said, vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. This case was super disturbing for a number of reasons, but I have a kid that's the same age as Laura Hobbs and Crystal Tobias. And
and my grandson is that age, too.
And I just couldn't. The gory details were hard to stomach. But if the police hadn't had their blinders on after the murder of those two little girls, just assuming that Laura's father was guilty because of his past and not considering all the evidence in front of them in the present to investigate the case, it's just, it's awful. It's horrible. Yeah. And, you know, for them, it was like, case closed. We win. Yay. But it really, nobody won. And again, it really had this entire, like, years-long situation has had lasting effects on
lots of people.
Lots of people. Yeah. And I mean, I was thinking about, what about, like, Laura's siblings? You know, like, where are they and how are they? Or Laura's mom. And we know about her dad because he was a really important part to the story. But like, I wonder about their families, like, and how are they? I know that there's a memorial, but like for reals, like, how are you guys? Are you guys after all of this?
Yeah.
And normally with like perpetrators and people who harm other people, it's usually people, you're more likely to be like hurt by somebody you know or a family member, right? But this guy was a complete stranger. And my impression, all I got to say is this case broke my heart. So I feel bad for everybody, Amanda's family. And then the women who survived the attacks, I'm glad they get to still keep their anonymity. But they were robbed of peace of mind.
Yes.
And maybe now they don't feel like they're victims. I don't know, because they're anonymous and we don't know their stories. I haven't read their books, but I just wonder how they are doing.
Yeah.
Because so much can be taken away and traumatized within you after an attack like that. So, but yeah. Shout out to them for surviving.
I hope they're okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
Beth, where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media.
This is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident. That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.
Twenty-four hours ago, I found out the person that I'd been dating and seeing for the last 6 months as a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks's lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series,
and that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris, and this is my story, Conning the Con.